castaway this week is a duke. He was born in Northern Ireland and spent an idyllic childhood on the banks of Lough Erne in County Fermanagh. But education in the English public school system and the comparatively early death of his father swept all that away. By the age of 19, he was managing one of Britain's greatest estates. At 27, he owned it. Today, he's one of this country's richest men, owner of 300 acres of prime London property, an estate in Cheshire, some of Scotland, shopping malls in Los Angeles, and other interests in America, Canada, Australia, and the Far East. The responsibility of these possessions affects him keenly. "I never think of giving up," he says. "I can't sell. It doesn't belong to me." He is Gerald Cavendish Grosvenor, 6th Duke of Westminster. If it doesn't belong to you, Gerald, who does it belong to?
Well, it belongs to my family. It's part of my heritage, as anything else is part of one's heritage, whether it be a building or whether it be green fields. In the context of eternity, if I'm lucky, I might live on this earth for 70 years. That estate has been with us for 300, 400, 500, 600 years. So I'm only a mere flicker in the process of time and the process of history.
But apparently you didn't even want to be that flicker. You were a reluctant heir, weren't you?
I think I was. I had this wonderful childhood in Northern Ireland. I was quite happy and contented to have lived there all my life. I knew what I wanted to be. I wanted to farm and take it really rather gently, I thought. And then because my uncle had no children, sadly his eldest son did die at a very early age, it was rather forced upon me. And I didn't actually know that I was going to inherit all this until about the age of 15.
But you, in turn, are going to force it upon your son. He will become the 7th Duke.
I will force nothing on anybody, let alone my children.
But you're husbanding it. That's really what I'm saying. You're looking after it, just as the other 5 dukes before you have. And
absolutely,
you hope to pass it on to the 7th Duke. And that's the way you feel things should happen.
It's the way that I feel things should happen. But in Hugh's case, obviously, I'd be delighted if he took over the responsibilities, because with the responsibilities come many rights, and they're indefinable between the two.
But just let me ask you, technically, just for the purpose of argument, if you wanted to sell it, you could, couldn't you? You could sell it all up and go and live the life of Riley on the Mediterranean.
Technically, one could.
But you never would.
And it has never crossed my mind. You don't inherit something just to sell it.
Well, what we do here is strip you of all those assets, and we cast
exactly
you alone on an island. I'm sure the idea appeals just a bit, doesn't it?
It does a little bit, yes.
Tell me about the first record you play.
Well, the first record I've chosen is Fleetwood Mac's Albatross, and I think I've chosen that after a great deal of deliberation as my opening record, purely on the basis that it has this wonderful solitude about it. And leading a busy and often confusing life, one longs on occasions for solitude. And I think that Fleetwood Mac has captured that giant seabird out in the middle of nowhere and with its solitude, with itself, just floating gently across the sea. And the combination of probably one of the largest flying birds in the world and the great ocean is almost irresistible to me.
Fleetwood Mac and Albatross. The history of how your family came by all this land is fascinating. Apparently it was William the Conqueror who handed it over in the first place, the whole of Cheshire, to one of your ancestors.
Yes, my ancestor, my kinsman, was a relation of William the Conqueror's, and he sent all the members of his family up to secure the borders against the Celtic fringe.
To some suppress were sent, the natives.
Well, exactly. And there were some sent to the Scottish border, and then there were some sent to the Welsh border. And we ended up on the North Wales border in order to keep the Welsh the other side of the River Dee.
And did the Welsh forgive your family?
Well, as you know, Celtic memories are very long, and 900 years is almost as if it were yesterday. So the subject is on occasions brought up every now and again.
But the real wealth came into the family in the 17th century, didn't it?
Yes, it was the 17th century really that brought it in, and the early part of the wealth came in through lead mining in North Wales. And then obviously subsequently to that, my family married, Sir Thomas Grosvenor married Mary Davis, who had this substantial dowry. She was a young lady of only 14, and her father put her up, as it were, for auction and
for an arranged marriage.
For an arranged marriage, really between Lord Berkeley of Berkeley Square fame and Sir Thomas Grosvenor, and Sir Thomas Grosvenor actually outbid Lord Berkeley.
And she brought with her a set of boggy fields.
Yes, I like to refer them to as farms. However, they were badly drained farms. Yes, technically, of course, they were boggy fields.
But they're now Mayfair, Belgravia.
And they're now Mayfair and Belgravia.
So Sir Thomas Grosvenor bid for her, as it were, and won. Mm. And so the wealth came into the Grosvenor family. He was a kind of unknown squire, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. He lived in Cheshire, and was accumulating a degree of wealth through the lead mines in North Wales, but then spotted the main chance.
Spotted Mary Davis.
Absolutely.
Hence Davis Street.
Yes, hence Davis Street. And indeed all the streets in and around Mayfair and Belgravia, an awful lot of them have got family connections. Mm. And indeed connections from Chester Square, mm. Chester Street, Little Chester Street.
But you've got them all in your name, Gerald Cavendish Grosvenor.
Yes. Absolutely.
Eaton Square, of course. Eaton with an A.
Eaton with an A, which is the name of our home up in Cheshire.
Yes.
And so a lot of the street names are Cheshire-orientated and North Wales-orientated.
Do you recall the moment when your father told you all this was going to be yours?
I will never forget it. It was shortly after my uncle died, and I remember him sitting me down, and really the dawning of the realisation of what was ahead of one almost made me run for the door, slam it and keep on running.
You were 15?
I was 15 years old, yes.
But your father had known since you were really very small that it was coming first his way and then yours, hadn't
he? Yes, he had, but it hadn't really dawned upon me. And I suppose it was actually quite clever of him to keep me, as it were, away from the main implications of it.
But you rebelled nevertheless, didn't
you? I did rebel to a degree. Like everybody else at that age, I grew my hair far too long. I had a terrible time finding my feet. I had a terrible time in understanding what the implications were. If you look at it against a background of a wonderful life, living on an island in Loch Earn, the other side of Enniskillen, 52 miles of lake, 365 islands, my two sisters, myself, my mother and father, and realising really for the first 15 years of one's life that one was just going to have this idyllic way of life. And then I had to face these daunting prospects. And the other thing I found very difficult to come to terms with was how differently people treated one. I was brought up, as I say, in Ulster, where you were treated purely on your own merits. You were treated because of who you are. And I was called Gerald all my life. There was no question of titles, and there was no questions of your grace this and your grace that and my lord this, my lord that. And I found that very difficult to come to terms with.
Do you still find it difficult?
Sometimes, yes. Sometimes.
Do you not like people calling you your grace?
I find it on occasions very embarrassing, even more so when people ask me what should they call me? Because then I do stumble like I've done just now.
Tell me about your second record.
My second record is the theme tune to Harry's Game. Harry's Game was a wonderful book, and it was a wonderful film. And the theme tune to that film is full of tragedy, and it is the only piece of music that I think encompasses the tragedy of Ireland so brilliantly. And, of course, the book and the film had a tragic ending of great misunderstanding. And that is the story of Ulster.
Clannad and the theme from Harry's Game. So you had this idyllic childhood on Loch Earn. Your father was a politician, so he was away a lot.
Yes.
But eventually you were sent away, weren't you? You were sent to prep school in Berkshire.
Yes, I was sent away at what I still regard as the absurdly young age of about 7. I suppose, like all my contemporaries, it was the conventional form of education.
But from Fermanagh, County Fermanagh, to Berkshire, to Sunningdale Prep
yes.
School is a big leap, isn't it?
It is, and especially when you're carrying a broad Ulster accent with you.
Oh, really?
It's an even bigger one.
When did you dump that?
Well, it was dumped dumped out of me, I suppose one could refer it to, by teasing. I was teased mercilessly about it.
At school?
Yes.
But there must have been huge cultural differences.
Yes, there was a great cultural difference. You see, coming from a very divided society and a very divided school society, which, of course, Ulster was then, in terms of Protestant schools and Roman Catholic schools, I came from a county which was basically 50-50 in terms of Protestants from Roman Catholics. And you see, it was very much in my culture to wonder who was what. And I found myself going around wondering, and indeed asking, whether someone was a Roman Catholic or a Protestant. And that was the biggest cultural divide, of course, that I had to overcome initially. And
why? Because they didn't know, or it didn't matter.
They didn't understand what I was talking about. And I mean, obviously, all these young boys looked at me as if I was stark raving mad.
But how were you going to respond when they said they were a Catholic?
I think I would have probably, in those days, probably ignored them. And I would have made my friends among a Protestant community. But fortunately, at the age of seven, most young boys actually don't really know what they are.
No.
So it wasn't really an issue.
But would it be fair to say you were traumatised by this business of being sent away?
I think I was, actually. Mm. I think I was.
Did you ever ask your mother why?
I did ask her why. And she said on reflection, because my father was an Ulster Unionist Member of Parliament for Fermanagh and South Tyrone. He was away an awful lot. She had three small children and, again, two other cousins living with us. So there were five of us, all of the same age, bit of a handful. And she said it was the accepted thing to do. And I said, why did you never challenge it? And she said, well, it never really crossed their minds. And with hindsight, she said they would have challenged the conventional wisdom.
Hmm. Would you send your own children away? Have you sent your children away?
No. My two eldest, 15 and 13, are at a day school in the Wirral.
They're girls.
Co-educational. They're girls. And they're happy. We see a lot of them. I don't see the point of having children and sending them away at the age of seven and get them back at the age of 19, complaining bitterly that they don't behave, because it's just as much up to the parents as it is up to the education system.
But what about the son and heir, Hugh, now aged four?
Hugh's now aged four. We've not made any decisions on his education at the moment. We're going to see how he develops. The likelihood is, oh, well, the certainty is that he'll go to the village school. That'll be his first step. And thereafter, it is a subjective question. We're looking at various different alternatives. But the alternative which we will both elect for, both Tally and myself, is the one wherein we can see him as often as possible and actually have him as a child and also as an adolescent. Because I believe it's part and parcel of one's responsibility in having children.
Record number three.
Record number three really is Elton John's Nikita, and I chose this for no other reason than it's a wonderful piece of music.
Hey, Nikita, is it cold? In your little corner of the world, you could roll around the globe and never find a warmer soul to know.
Elton John and Nikita. So you left school, Gerald Grosvenor, before A-levels. You only got two O-levels.
Yes, I only got two O-levels.
Do you, sometimes people rather cruelly allege that they were woodwork and art, but they weren't, were they?
No, they were sort of marginally better than that. They were grade one in English language and grade one in history.
But would you put that down to the fact that you have only two, down to the fact that you were unacademic or unhappy?
I was unhappy. The interesting thing is, actually, that I've never failed an exam since I left school. And, of course, I've taken five army exams, wherein I've been happy and wherein I've been motivated. I wasn't motivated at school. I was unhappy because I didn't understand the system that I came into. I didn't try. I never applied myself. I found it very difficult to make friends at school.
You more or less took over the family firm, as I said at the beginning, at the age of 19, because your father was ill, and you've effectively run it ever since. That's for the past 25 years, two O-levels notwithstanding. Would you say, therefore, that you had a natural flair for it, or has it been pure graft?
I don't think so. I think it's been a combination. You don't need O-levels to lead. You don't need O-levels to have judgment. You don't need O-levels to make decisions and be decisive.
But where did the ability to do that come from?
I think instinctively. I think my army training in those early days did help me, and I've carried that on through my life.
But you're worth less on paper today, aren't you, than when you took over?
Well, yes, that is somebody's subjective judgment of what I'm worth. And people have had shots at it forever, but don't take those figures as gospel, because
they
are
gospel.
But do you
know what you're worth?
Oh, yes, I do, and I'm not prepared to say, because I believe that that's my business. It's what I do with the wealth, rather than what I am worth, which I believe is more important.
I want to talk to you about what you do with it, but tell me first of all, obviously it's hard work, but it has its compensations. What would you say was your greatest luxury?
My greatest luxury is having my own aeroplane. It means that I do have the ability to cover enormous distances in a day and still be able to get home.
How long does it take from London to Cheshire?
35 minutes to fly from Chester to London. And if I get stuck on the A40, it can take anything up to an hour and a half to do the last 12 miles.
And the butler meets you on the tarmac?
No, he certainly doesn't. I park my car up at Northolt. And I'm met at Northolt, obviously, because it's an RAF base.
Can I ask what kind of car it is?
It's Jaguar. Rather old, too, before you ask.
Tell me about your next record.
My next record is Ferry Across the Mersey by Jerry and the Pacemakers. And I've chosen this really for two reasons. First of all, coming to Cheshire from Northern Ireland, my first and immediate contact with the Northwest was very much Liverpool, which I've always had a great fondness for, and particularly the Scouse. I commanded a Scouse squadron, so Liverpudlians have been with me all my life in their various guises and forms. And I think the history of the ferry across the Mersey, which now, of course, no longer exists, is a wonderful history, as I think the history of Liverpool is.
Life goes on day after day. Hearts torn in every way. So ferry across the Mersey, 'cause this land's the place I love, and here I'll stay.
Jerry and the Pacemakers and Ferry Across the Mersey. You hit the headlines a couple of years ago because you resigned from the Tory party despite historic family connections. Why did you do it?
My family have been an integral part of the Tory party, and as I say, my father was an Ulster Unionist Member of Parliament. However, that was, in those days, very much part of the Tory party. And so, therefore, our political ties go back a very long time. And I didn't leave it easily. It was a very difficult decision to make. However, I always believed that one of the fundamental beliefs of the Conservative Party, and being what a Conservative was all about, was the privacy of contract, the right of ownership, the sanctity of ownership, the property-owning democracy. When are you part of that property-owning democracy, and when aren't you part of that property-owning
so
democracy?
So it was the Leasehold Reform Act that really
yes, it was.
Did for you, because that gave people who held leases the right to buy the freehold from you, the landlord.
Absolutely. And I understand legislation being framed for the public good. What I do not understand is legislation being framed on the basis that it is against one individual for the benefit of another individual.
But surely if a family has lived in one of your properties for some time and it was their permanent home and they've lavished a lot of care on its interior and they've decorated it and loved it and so on, isn't there a point at which it's only fair that they should be able to buy it outright from you?
That, of course, is an argument. However, when they signed those leases, in the first instance, they signed a contract freely entered into by me and by them, and it was their choice to live within that system. It is not as if the whole of London is taken up through the leasehold system. There are other places to live as well.
But why is it fair that one person, i.e. you, should go on gaining immense wealth from properties, which, as we've established, came into your family by chance and you inherited by chance, and your family should go on in benefiting from those properties for decade upon decade upon decade, and nobody has a chance to buy them. So private ownership is not extended in any way.
Well, as I say, London is a big place. I choose to run that part of which I have control over in a certain way for not only the benefit of myself, which quite clearly there is, but I believe it's actually for the benefit of that part of London as well. I think it looks good. I think the standard of management in terms of what the squares look like, Belgrave Square, Chester Square, Grosvenor Square, I think the standard of upkeep and I think the standard of maintenance, I think is very high.
But the Leasehold Reform Act did go through. You resigned the party anyway. What's been its effect? That was 2 years ago.
Well, its effect at the moment has been minimal. I think the long-term effects are very serious to to me.
So it's the thin end of the wedge, is it? It chips away at the Grosvenor
Estate. It is the thin end of the wedge, and it chips away at our residential landholdings, which, one has to say, is not the most profitable part of our business in any event, because we tend to put more money back into our residential stock than we actually do back into our commercial stock.
But if somebody comes along who's lived in one of your houses with a lease for more than a couple of years and demands to buy its freehold, they can?
They can, at a discounted price, bearing in mind the amount they paid originally for the lease and the length of the lease. So it's not open market value.
Hmm.
It's less than open market value.
Do you feel deprived without your membership of the Conservative Party?
Not particularly. I feel sad that I had to leave. I had to leave because of my own conscience, and I took a moral stand. And I don't regret it, but I feel very sad about it.
Next piece of music.
My next piece of music is Luciano Pavarotti singing Panis Angelicus. Not only do I believe it is the most wonderful piece of music, but it also helps me to forget about the Leasehold Reform Act, perhaps.
Luciano Pavarotti singing Panis Angelicus by César Franck with the National Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Kurt Herbert Adler. You married in 1978, Gerald, and
yes.
You had two daughters very quickly.
Yes, we did, yes.
And then nothing, no son and heir.
Nothing. No. One always hoped for a son and heir. Every man does. There's nothing that isn't anything but basic human nature, I don't think. I didn't want him for the popularly conceived reasons. I wanted him purely because I wanted a son, like mothers like to have daughters
as
well.
But what would have happened to the title if you hadn't?
The title would have died out. It would have reverted to the Marquis of Westminster, which is, as it were, number two in the batting. And
and the girls would have inherited the business.
The girls would have basically inherited the business, yes. I had no hang-up about that. I had no difficulty. I am a strong believer in primogeniture, always have been. It's always been a very strong facet in my family. But it was never such a worry to me as it was to everybody else that Hugh didn't appear.
But then he did, 1991.
1991, yes.
And you've said before now that he has this very large silver spoon in his mouth.
Yes.
And you've said, you've been quoted as saying that it's dangerous, that it can seduce you. What do you mean by that?
Well, I've always said that one of my great aims in life is actually to get that silver spoon out of his mouth. It can seduce you. It can seduce you into wealth on any scale, can seduce you into a world that you don't really think that anybody else exists in it except yourself. You become very self-centred. You become very isolated from reality.
But it didn't happen to you. I mean, you were, one remembers very much, you were cited as being the most eligible bachelor in the land, and women were sending you their photographs. I mean, you could have had any woman you wanted, you could have had anything. You didn't get seduced.
No, I think I was lucky, and I think the...
So might you have been? Was there a moment?
I think I might have been, yes. One looks around, certainly people of one's own age who have great wealth, and perhaps some of them haven't been so fortunate as I in terms of being able to come to terms with it.
We're talking about the temptation of drugs, among other things.
I'm talking about the temptations of drugs. I'm talking about the temptation of idleness. And what interests me at the moment, actually, greatly, is the great debate raging at the moment over the large lottery winners and how they're coping with great wealth suddenly landed in their laps. And I understand the difficulties that it does bring. I understand the jealousies that it brings, and you have to resist those jealousies. You have to understand that human nature being what it is, people are inherently jealous. And envy, one is subjected, I think, to envy on almost an everyday basis. And I understand the human nature that actually drives that. I think we do live in a society which perhaps certainly these days is not at ease with itself. And any society that isn't at ease with itself does tend to generate extremes, whether it be extremes in terms of political polarization or extremes of envy or extremes of jealousy. Certainly today it's got very much worse than it used to be. But again, I can't go to bed worrying about it every night, and I can't wake up in the morning worrying about it. And if I continue to do what I believe is right, in the best interests of my family and others, then my conscience is settled, because I'm answerable to that and I'm answerable to my maker.
Number six.
My number six song is, I think, probably out of my entire selection, is my favourite. It is the chorus of the Hebrew Slaves from Verdi's Nabucco, and it is the piece of music that my mother was buried to. And I remember her coffin being taken out of the cathedral in Enniskillen by six RUC men, and they were doing a slow march to Nabucco. And it was a big, rather public service with TV cameras and things like that, none of which any of us ever wanted, but it was public. But at that moment, when the RUC men were marching down with my mother's coffin, it silenced the lot, and it left, I think, an indelible mark on certainly my memory and all those that were there.
Chorus of the Hebrew Slaves from Verdi's Nabucco with the Vienna State Opera and Chorus conducted by Lamberto Gardelli. You mentioned the army several times, Gerald. That's the TA, the Territorials.
The Territorials, yes.
You couldn't become a regular soldier because of the business.
Yes, I was actually going to go into the regular army, and then, of course, my father went ill just about the time I was going to go in.
So the TA has sort of fulfilled those ambitions for
you? The TA has more than filled those ambitions. The Territorials have given me an enormous part of my life, which, after 23 years, I still look back with tremendous fondness.
But it's important to you, as I understand it, because you've won it for yourself.
Exactly. It's very important to me that I've actually had a chance to prove myself against my peers and to take and pass the examinations that were required, because the army weren't in the business of issuing favours to me or indeed to anybody else, because those days are long gone.
So you competed and you won. How many days a week does it take up?
Well,
time?
I never go through one day without having contact in one way and or another with army matters.
Then there's the Cheshire estate to run as well, and the family to see and so on. So with
yes.
any luck, you can avoid London as often as possible.
Well, let's put it this way. I'm not a Londoner at all, by birth or indeed by inclination. I'm a countryman by birth and by inclination, and that is what is important to me.
But you genuinely don't like it, do you?
I'm not very happy in amongst a lot of traffic, a lot of fuss, a lot of people. I'm not an urban boy, never have been.
Record number seven.
Number seven is the Radetzky March, and this goes back to my army life, as it were. The Radetzky March is wonderfully cavalry. I'm in the Territorial Army, but more specifically, I'm in the Yeomanry, which is the cavalry side of the Territorial Army. And the Radetzky March is wonderfully cavalry. It shows all that flash and dare of cavalrymen of old, and I hope of the modern-day one as well.
Thank you.
Johann Strauss's Radetzky March, played by the Berlin Radio Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Ferenc Fritschai. I meant to ask you about Eaton Hall, the family seat, which your
yes.
father, I think, rebuilt in 1973. Much criticised. I think even your friend, the Prince of Wales, has called it the Inn on the Park. Do you like it?
I didn't like it. We've now rebuilt it. And
Again.
Because it seems to be a tradition of my family never to be satisfied in what they were living in at the time, and so therefore changing it.
But you didn't demolish the whole thing?
Didn't demolish it, but just about demolished it, moved out of it for 3 years, and then reconstructed really the whole house.
But it does seem a terrible shame that somebody who owns some of the most classically beautiful buildings in Britain lives in a kind of modernistic construction, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yes, I think perhaps it may seem odd. However, I think it is, again, a piece of architectural history, like it or not, that I can leave behind me.
But you like it now,
I like
you?
It very
it
much.
It no longer looks like the county ambulance headquarters.
And it now or the Führer Bunker, as somebody else referred it to. It had a number of names. In fact, there was one moment when I was about to put up a signpost with all the names on it, so we could have a competition.
So let's pretend now, then, that you are about to be shipwrecked, and the money is no use to you anymore at all. You're cast away, you're alone. How will you cope?
I would cope, really, I think, very well. I was born and bred on an island in the middle of a very large lake with only one or two houses on it. I'd be very happy on my island. I would look forward to it, in
so
fact.
So yours isn't a tropical island. Yours is in the middle of Loch Earn.
No,
really,
my
it?
Island would be probably either off the west coast of Ireland or the west coast of Scotland. I don't want any of this tropics business. I couldn't go through a year without seeing the changes of the seasons. And so therefore, I would pick a temperate isle. I would not pick a tropical isle. Also, I would like the wind. And having been born in a rainstorm, I'm quite happy to live in one for the rest of my life. So rain's not a problem. And the crashing waves would send me to sleep at night. So wonderfully unromantic, and none of this heat.
Last record.
My last record in many ways refers to what I've just said, in terms of the fact that I believe this record really so clearly and so cleverly sums up within and contained within its music the West Coast, whether it be the West Coast of Ireland or the west coast of Scotland. Both coasts I love dearly. And it is Wings, the Marl of Kintyre.
Marl of Kintyre, on me strolling in from the sea. My desire is always to be on Marl of Kintyre.
Wings and Marl of Kintyre. If you could only take one of those records with you, Gerald?
I would take Albatross, because I think when my storm is blowing, I think I would play it to myself, and it would calm me down, although it wouldn't calm the storm down, but it would certainly calm me down.
What about a book?
One of the only reasons I ever got a history O-level was as a result of reading a number of boys' books, as it were, and the one I would select is or was written by G.A. Henty, Through Russian Snows, because quite categorically I'm going to enter my second childhood whilst I'm on my island. So I shall read Through Russian Snows by G.A. Henty, playing Albatross.
What about a luxury?
My luxury would be a telescope, and I would be able to watch my albatross through the telescope, if I'm allowed one, and I would be able to watch other forms of life through my telescope. And when I became very old and exceedingly decrepit, and half-blind, I'd be able to read my G.A. Henty Through Russian Snows through it. So it would have a dual purpose, which I would look forward to.
Gerald Grosvenor, Duke of Westminster, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you very much.